Well, good morning. Please go ahead and try to find a seat. I think there are a couple here in the front of the room and maybe a couple in the back of the room as well. But let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My name is Catherine Bliss, and I'm a Deputy Director and Senior Fellow within the CSIS Global Health Policy Center, where I also direct the Global Water Futures Project. And it's a pleasure to see so many people out this morning for the second in our series on the Millennium Development Goals Summit, or, as it is formally known, the High-Level Plenary Meeting of the General Assembly, which will take place in New York City next week from September 20th through the 22nd. So last Tuesday here at CSIS, we kicked off the series with an event featuring United States Ambassador at Large for Global Women's Issues, Milan Verveer. And during the meeting, Ambassador Verveer offered a presentation on making the most of the MDG summit, advancing progress through the empowerment of women and girls. This morning, we will examine one of those goals, Millennium Development Goal 7, which is to ensure environmental sustainability, focusing on the third target, which is to have by 2015 the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water and sanitation. So in June of this year, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon released a report on global progress toward meeting the Millennium Development Goals. And in the report's section on the water and sanitation target, the text noted that the world is on track to meet the drinking water target, though much remains to be done in some regions. In particular, it emphasized that accelerated and targeted efforts are needed to bring drinking water to all rural households. But on sanitation, as many of you know, the report was not as optimistic. It warned that with half of the population of developing regions without sanitation, the 2015 target appears to be out of reach. Indeed, in the run-up to next week's summit, there has been quite a bit of advocacy focused on the water and sanitation target within Goal 7. Last week in Stockholm, Sweden, at World Water Week, the meetings which are hosted by the Stockholm International Water Institute, participants issued the Stockholm Statement to the high-level plenary meeting on the MDGs. And the statement notes the relevance of the management and provision of water resources, water services, and sanitation to addressing all of the MDGs, and urged participants at the high-level plenary meeting to recognize fully and act upon the fundamental role of water resources, drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene for achieving the Millennium Development Goals. Now, to help us make sense of the place of water and sanitation activities within the larger MDG context, we are fortunate to have with us this morning two experts in the fields of water and sanitation who have done quite a bit of thinking on the linkages between water and sanitation activities, the global health agenda, and development issues. John Barrazzo, to my immediate left, is chief of the Maternal and Child Health Division within the Bureau of Global Health at the United States Agency for International Development. Seema Mangi is senior water, to my second left over here, is senior water and sanitation specialist at the World Bank. And you have their longer bios on the sheet with the agenda that was just passed out, so I will let you read about their experience and many accomplishments at your leisure. But this morning, I've asked each of them to consider the following questions in developing their remarks for our discussion. And these are pretty simple. It's, you know, what is the status of meeting the water and sanitation target in the various world regions? How are their institutions, the World Bank and USAID, working with partners to reach the water and sanitation target within Millennium Development Goal 7? To what extent is progress on the water and sanitation target important for success in meeting the other Millennium Development Goals? And what outcomes, resolutions, or actions related to water and sanitation are we likely to see coming out of the summit next week? So each speaker will offer some remarks, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion afterwards. But before I ask Seema Mangi from the World Bank to start the session, let me just remind you that later in the day, CSIS will host related discussions on Millennium Development Goal 1, which is to eradicate extreme poverty and hunger. And that will take place on this level, I think, in the room next door from 11 to 12:30. And we'll feature speakers from the World Bank and the World Food Program. And then from 2:30 until 4 p.m. this afternoon, we will discuss Millennium Development Goal 6, which is to combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, with a discussion about the AIDS 2031 project. So I hope your schedules might permit you to join us for one or both events. But if not, I believe we will have audio recordings of the events available online at csis.org. So now let me turn to Seema for her remarks.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for the introduction and for inviting the World Bank to speak at this event. This is something, the MDGs, that we have done a lot of work on. This is the culmination of years of work where we will be at the UN summit next week. And, of course, what I'd like to do is stress what the World Bank has done over the past 10 years. And with only 5 years remaining before the 2015 target date, we really urgently need to intensify our efforts to ensure that we achieve the MDGs, or at least are doing better 5 years from now than currently. Water supply and sanitation is an extremely important sector in the World Bank. It has linkages with almost all of our sectors: environment, health, nutrition. So it's really the core of development in many of our country programs. Myself, I've been at the World Bank for 15 years. 14 of these years have been spent in operations and lending directly to countries. Until recently, actually until just 6 months ago, I was based in Turkey, and I was covering and responsible for the water supply and sanitation program, solid waste, and municipal infrastructure for both Turkey and as well as Ukraine. And two, as I was just mentioning to John and Catherine, two very difficult countries to work in. And I'd like to give you not only the views on the MDGs, what we are doing, but to also point out that what we're doing on the MDGs is not separate from our larger, broader program on water supply and sanitation and our overall development goals. This is just something that we utilize to jumpstart our talks with the clients and to get our clients in a target and in a focused way concentrated on trying to have some impact and some accomplishments. Just a little bit of a background on the challenges that we face in the sector, and some of you may be familiar with the data and the numbers, but it's certainly overwhelming. Over 884 million people still lack access to safe water, and 2.5 billion lack access to basic sanitation. This is really a huge challenge and something the World Bank has been working on for 50 years, and the development and results have been very slow, much slower than we would have liked. The costs of inadequate water and sanitation are very, very high. Until today, 2010, 1.6 million children die every year from diarrhea, of which 90% is related to waterborne diseases. Most of this, of course, is in developing countries, and all of this is attributed to sanitation, water supply, and hygiene, a lack of it, of course. The economic costs for the countries, again, we don't look at this separately as water supply and sanitation, but overall is the economy of the country is very, very high. And the World Bank does, I think, some very good strategic and analytical work. And estimates are in the cases of Colombia, El Salvador, Peru, and Guatemala, in a study that was done on Latin America, that these costs of economic costs of poor coverage of water supply and sanitation are estimated at 1% of GDP. And that's certainly a very, very high amount. In terms of time, an estimated 40 billion hours per year are spent on collecting water in sub-Saharan Africa. This is a significant amount of time. I'm sure none of us would want to do that. And, of course, it's really women who are bearing the burden of this. Another challenge that we face very much when we're working with our clients, with our countries, is water supply is very different from sanitation. It may be the same institutions that are providing these services, but really two very different animals. And these, in turn, differ very much, be it rural, be it urban. These differences are not only in the costs and the economies of skills, but very much from the poverty dimension and the institutions that provide these services. So you're really tackling many, many sub-issues within the whole water paradigm, and that's certainly not easy to do. In terms of numbers of people without access, the challenge, of course, is very much in South Asia, in East Asia. This is where you have the large, large mega cities, huge urban growth, lots of migration into urban areas. And the challenge is not only just in providing access and ensuring that this is running smoothly and good operation and maintenance, but continuing to respond to the challenges of everyone migrating, net internal migration to these large, large cities within countries. But in terms of percentages and public health, the very large, large challenges in Africa. I have many colleagues who work in Africa. We set up project units. We work with our clients. And there is not one colleague that I have spoken to who has said to me that, well, I was, you know, we set up a group of people to work with, and every time they come back, there's always someone or the other who has either passed away due to HIV. I know you will be talking about that, MDG, later. And the villages and the rural areas that they go to, I mean, they really have dismal stories and dismal pictures to present. So it's really a very serious area for us, and a lot of effort is put on this. And I think the top levels of management at the World Bank place a strong emphasis on this. So this is something that is helpful. That's what I wanted to say, just in terms of background, so you get a better idea. And in terms of progress to date, some of the countries that have good economic policies, many of the developing countries have made significant progress in achieving the MDGs. But then when we were hit with the global economic crisis, this has certainly stalled quite a bit. The global food, the fuel, the economic crisis, this has really set back progress to the MDGs. And it's estimated that about 65 million people more are living on $1.25 per day than prior to the crisis. So this puts a different dimension to the problem and certainly perpetuates it and makes our work much more challenging. Before the crisis, I think that we can say overall on the MDGs that there was good progress on poverty reduction, gender parity in primary and secondary school, and fortunate for us on water. And progress was far less than stellar on the core human development indicators. This is on child and maternity mortality, primary school completion, hunger, and unfortunate for us, in sanitation. And that's something that you will hear over and over again, and certainly something that will be repeated at the summit. In terms of the World Bank and our objectives of our work, as I mentioned earlier, we don't see the MDGs, the target, just as a standalone, but it's really very much an integral part of our broader water supply and sanitation program. And our purpose really is, I think we could say broadly two. One is to call global attention to the urgent action needed on the sanitation MDG as well as the water one, and then to highlight the progress and the initiatives that have been led by the World Bank in the water supply and sanitation progress. The world, as you know, is likely to achieve the MDG target on water supply, but of course that marks huge discrepancies within region. Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, the coverage is not even 60%, and that's well below the 75% target that is actually the target. And in sanitation, with current trends, I think this is a foregone conclusion that the world will not meet the sanitation MDG targets. And even if we were to meet both water supply and sanitation targets, you will note that still 800 million people would be without access to, would have lack of access to clean water, and 1.8 billion, I mean, that's a staggering amount, would lack sanitation. And that's certainly a huge, huge problem for us, and trying to think of ways of how to improve this situation. We really work in two fronts, in two sort of strategies when we're working with the MDGs. One is very much on basic access. And here our purpose is really just impact, impact, impact. Can we increase coverage? How can we increase coverage? And what do you do? What kind of innovative schemes do you put in place to just show impact on the ground? And the bulk of our resources, our manpower, our funding is trying to improve the basic access. The other way that we work together is that we have various subsectors at the World Bank, and I think very good professionals, both in the infrastructure sectors, working on water supply, working on health, on nutrition, on the economic side, and we try to work very closely in terms of linkages. And I think the linkages are obvious, but something that should be stressed is that you know, with working in water and sanitation, it's in a community or a neighborhood directly impacts the MDGs in so many other areas. And we see this very much, as you can imagine, in children's health. Even today, I mean, as we sit here, it's 42,000 children per week that are dying related to waterborne diseases. And our data collection is quite strong, and this number is actually supposed to be higher than this, and there's a lot of debate on the number that we're quoting. Improved nutrition, it's really no good for kids to eat nutritious meals if they can't absorb the nutrients because of they have diarrhea or because of lack of quality in drinking water. In sub-Saharan Africa, babies dying from diarrhea is 520 times higher than in the U.S. and Europe. And unfortunately, there has not been many positive increases in this region, in this area. And this is where a lot of resources, where our President Zolik has placed a lot of emphasis. But the challenge is so high, and it's been difficult, really, to get some improvement in this area. The gender benefits, the increased improved education of when you've been, it's been proven over and over again that where you have secure girls' latrines, where you have access to toilet facilities in schools, this has drastically improved girls' education. So it's very important that we work both in terms of basic access, including increasing these numbers, as well as looking at the broader linkages. And when our strategies are put into place, we work very closely with our colleagues and who are working in the health sector, who are working on the economists, who are working on the country portfolio to see that this can be done. And because water and sanitation cuts across so many MDGs, one-third of all of the bank finance projects since 1997 have been water-related. So in one shape or form, you have the water presence there, and the bank has been increasing its resources to the sector. And since 2003, both the bank, we actually have two windows. One is a soft window called IDA, and which is for the low-income countries, and they get very good financial rates when they borrow from the World Bank from this, and then a more stringent one called IBRD. That lending has almost tripled to a projected $4.4 billion. So that's really a lot of money. And I give you this these numbers so you see that not only is the World Bank the largest external funder in the sector, but despite all of the funding that goes into the sector, the challenges are very high, and the numbers are, of course, a lot still needs to be done. Where has all of this money been going? Currently, there's about $14 billion, which has been allocated to the water supply and sanitation sector. That means $14 billion right now is committed worldwide to do infrastructure investments in this sector, as well as technical assistance and providing training, and so both hard and soft works. And of this, about 60% is in water supply and 40% in sanitation and wastewater. In the 90s, there was a lot of different opinions on what should be done, because it was very hard to get public sector institutions to respond to working with external financiers in the water sector, and there was a big impetus of having the private sector come in, but that has not been the case, and so there was a decline 10 years ago, 15 years ago in the water sector lending, but now we have right now, just in the past year alone, $4.4 billion of new commitments. So this is a lot of money, and where is this funding going? A lot of this funding is going to East Asia. This is ironic because East Asia is actually one of the best performers in attaining the MDGs. And a lot of you may ask us, well, why isn't the bulk of this funding going to Sub-Saharan Africa? And I sort of expect that question later during the Q&A questions. And I will be able to explain that in more detail. But East Asia remains the primary region to receive the financing. And this is largely due to China, because it pays a lot of emphasis on attaining the MDGs. One of the most serious countries in trying to meet the targets, and really has a comprehensive national plan in doing this, so it's quite interesting. And the bulk of this is spent on urban wastewater collection and treatment in middle-income countries. And I think there the bank can really, and I want to be forthright with you, can be quite criticized that where the countries are most water-stressed or perhaps have the least capacity and are the poorest, not all of the financing is necessarily directed to that. And again, this has to do with institutions. It has to do with governments wanting to work with the World Bank, governments being able to use the money. And this may surprise you, but it's one thing to get the money, but it's much, much harder to actually use it. And nobody ever believed that over the past 15 years when we'd be preparing projects with them. And they just say, you know, well, we can spend this in 12 months, 15 months. But that's really the challenge, is actually implementation and utilizing these funds, and that bringing us back to our issue of impact on the ground. So a lot of money, I think good progress in water supply and sanitation, but what has not been positive in terms of results on the ground has been the sanitation. It's been a very difficult sector for us, and it's often referred to as the orphan sector or the neglected sector, and in many ways it is. And part of the problem is that it's just straddled between so many different subsectors. You've got water, you've got health, you've got environment, education, nutrition, gender, you name it. Sanitation somehow or the other is touching on those and on these multiple sectors. And then sanitation is seen very much not only multiple responsibilities, but as a household good, but it also has a strong communal impact as well. So this is quite difficult. And very interesting, but when you go into towns, when you go into cities, irrespective of the sizes, the demand is always for water and very little for sanitation. And that always surprises me, but survey after survey has shown that. And very interesting, and that probably has been part of the problem, but I think there's been some good cases where, you know, now the challenge is really of improving the household sanitation. I think we've gotten better at covering urban sewage, the sewage in the urban areas, and now really the main challenge is how do we move forward in the urban populations that use household sanitations, and how can these facilities be serviced economically, hygienically, safely? And another issue is that the private sector is generally not interested in sanitation. And whether our belief is more leaning towards public sector, private sector, if we want to reach the MDG targets, you need that private sector financing as well. So a lot of focus on this, on the sanitation and on basic access to sanitation. But without a doubt, development there has been slow. The MDG summit happening next week, the World Bank has been very active in this, and we have set up in-house a task force. It is, run by the Vice President. It's managed, chaired by the Vice President of the Human Development Network, and we have put together a fairly strong paper on the MDGs, and it's titled Unfinished Business, because there's really a lot that still needs to be done. And the whole idea behind the summit is what can we do the next 5 years? One is the decade that has passed, but the challenges for the next 5 years, and how can we keep the clients and our countries on track on attaining these MDGs? And a lot of our lending, our strategies, this is a very good, you can almost say, a public relations event, the seriousness of it, I should not say public relations, but it certainly captures the attention of your countries, the presidents, the prime ministers, and this is something that the analytical piece that the World Bank has put together has forwarded all over to the ministers of finance of many of the countries that borrow from us, to the ministers of waters, and there will be two side events that the World Bank will be hosting there. One is actually on innovative financing in the water sector, and another one will be on monitoring and evaluation. There isn't a standalone water event that the World Bank is involved in, but there is something that the UN is doing, an important session on water and accessibility to it, which will be with the governments of Tajikistan, Korea, and two other bilaterals. So the idea was that the UN would take the lead on this. We work very closely John will speak later, of course, and we work very closely with USAID in many of our programs. USAID, I think, is an excellent organization in the sense that it's decentralized and they're working very closely with the clients on the ground. And we are now developing a memorandum of understanding on the water sector. That's something that's currently being drafted, and we hope very closely to work together in our programs, particularly with countries that are struggling in the MDGs and also on the broader water supply and sanitation program. Very good cooperation with UNICEF. Last spring, the World Bank IMF meetings were held. You may be aware they're held in the fall and the spring of every year. And we hosted a high-level meeting with UNICEF, and about 24 ministers, largely from African nations, were here. And something different was done, that the ministers of water were invited as well as the ministers of finance were invited, because this is something which is critical to note. Unless you don't have your ministers of finance on board, the ones who control the purse strings, the ones who control the budget, very little is done. And the fact that they were there with their ministers who are responsible for the water sector, this was something that was well received. And there, very much the challenge was to allocate more funding to the sector. Why is this all so difficult? Why is the water sector so difficult? Why is attaining the MDGs and sanitation so difficult? And I think it would really take years to talk about this, but I just want to give you very brief snapshots on the problems that we face. And it's difficult for many people who are outside of the sector to understand that the major constraints in water supply and sanitation, in having that impact, on having the policy reforms in place and having people pay for the services and having reliable services, is really not technical at all, but much more social, political, institutional, financial. And we have faced so many challenges when we're on the ground. When we're preparing programs, we talk very little about the engineering aspects or the technical aspects. And even though the bulk of the financing is spent on the hardware, on the infrastructure, it's really issues like political instability, it's corruption, something the World Bank doesn't talk much about, but, you know, quietly, indirectly somehow mentions it occasionally. Social dislocation through urban migration, what I had mentioned to you earlier, and simply population growth. The bulk of our developing countries' populations are very, very young, and this is a huge challenge, and this has been really a non-technical challenge, and then when you add the issues of climate change, hydrology, environment, this just magnifies the problem. But the point here is that it's really the non-technical problems that are very difficult to tackle with, and this is not easy to do, particularly when you're working in other people's countries, when you are the World Bank, when you're seen as a, you know, very dominating type of institution. So very soft challenges is the point that I want to say. One thing I'd really like to stress is the problems that we have with the institutions. And you may say to yourself, well, you talk a lot about institutional strengthening, but what institutions? And there are many, many institutions. You begin with your Ministry of Finance, who you have to get on board in order to show the importance of the sector. You have your ministries that you're working with. You have your utilities that are actually providing the services in cities. You have in the towns and the small cities the town provider or the municipality or the department that's providing it. And when you do investments, you eventually leave, and it's these very institutions that have to operate and maintain the services. And I cannot tell you how many times you do very strong projects, very good projects, new infrastructure, and 2-3 years after all of the construction has been built, there simply isn't enough funds to operate and maintain the system. And this has really been a large problem. And John, if I may say, I think USAID has been hit with this problem. The World Bank has been hit with this problem. This is a problem that many of the international finance institutions face. And until you don't have those professionals on the ground that are able to run the system, you will be in a situation that you're working, let's say, in a Pakistan, or you're working in a Nigeria. I'm saying the most difficult cases. I shouldn't scare you, but whichever country you're in, it doesn't matter. You will be doing the same type of project, the same type of investments 20, 30, 40 years later. And that's certainly not going to help your cause in reaching the MDGs. And this is really the problem that we have faced. As I mentioned earlier, I've spent over a decade of putting projects in place, and I cannot tell you how difficult that is to put even a simple $20 million in project in place for basic rehabilitation of pipes, even. I mean, let alone wastewater treatment or so, but it's just rehabilitation of old, dilapidated pipes. A $20 million project in Moldova will be as complicated to do as a $350 million project in Argentina or Turkey. The manpower it takes, the soft skills that is required, the management aspect of it very, very difficult. And so we cannot emphasize enough when we talk to our clients anywhere in the world of the importance of the institutions and what is left behind. And very interesting and to be expected that when you go to your countries, you're lending, you're trying to talk about the MDGs, you're trying to talk about impact. Nobody wants to borrow for anything except for hardware. So be it pipes, be it pumps, but if it comes to anything soft, whether it is technical assistance, whether it is advisory, and it's understandable, but the problem is, and the dilemma is, that it's actually the institutions and these type of very soft sort of areas that not much is documented on, which are the most difficult to tackle. And then when you have governments that are changing, I was working in Ukraine. We had 5 ministry reorganizations during the preparation of a project that took 19 months, and we had 6 new ministers. So you can imagine what you're doing. And when the ministers go, some of them also replace the technical staff. Not the core technical staff, but the technical staff that can make decisions and who we need on board to get a project running and to get funds flowing and to actually start implementation. it's very, very difficult. So I really can't emphasize that, be it the MDGs, be it the broader water supply and sanitation program of trying to get clean water and sanitation to as many people as possible, I think this has always been the dilemma. The other dilemma of capital. Of course, the sector needs far more financing than is available. The donors, the 16, 18 fairly rich countries, are retrenching from a lot of commitments just due to the crises. This certainly doesn't help very much. And the estimates are that about $30 billion per annum is needed to meet the water supply and sanitation MDG targets. This is a significant amount of money, and this doesn't even include sewage treatment. And the estimates that are going into the sector is about half of that, about $15 billion. And this is mostly from public financing, internal cash generation, and self-provision from countries. So that's something to bear in mind. It's not coming from external, but it's coming from internal. And then I think we need to be very realistic about the capital, the limitations of the financing that is available, the private sector, which we really need, whether, again, you like them or not, you need that financing, because it's simply, there simply is not enough financing in governments, in the budgets of governments, in order to meet the funds required for meeting the MDGs. And the issues of risk. I mean, there's huge risks when you work in this sector. There's huge reputational risk for the World Bank when we work in these sectors, and the water sector is really a very political area. And so a lot that goes into play here, and a lot of these challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis. Maybe if I give you a little bit of a negative picture, I just want to very briefly give you some positives. I think I of course am talking about the World Bank, and I certainly don't want to come here and promote the World Bank, but I just want you to know some of the work that has been done, and there have been good projects, bad projects, but I'd like to highlight today some of the project specific examples that have been positive. In Yemen, between 1997 and 2003, almost 2 million people were provided access to safe clean water. This was from the initial 800,000 that was actually projected, so this was a good increase, and this is in a very difficult environment in the country. Yemen is one of the most water-stressed countries. It's a very dry and arid area. Very difficult working environment. I think very good results in China. Between 89 and 2006, the World Bank has supported, helped provide 25 million people access to access to water supply, to safe drinking water. This is a huge, huge accomplishment, and I think a lot should be said about the role of the Chinese government in this. Again, I cannot say enough times about what a serious development partner they are, and they certainly have their strategy in place, and they know what they need to do, and then the World Bank just comes in and facilitates this, and this is really, I think, the way that it should be. In Burkina Faso, between 2001 and 2007, 1.5 million people were served. In Colombia as well, you had in Cartagena, 1 million people. And in Senegal, we've had some very good results as well. And I just want to say that in post-conflict countries, I think that is where the bank has been quite useful, quite successful. And in Bosnia alone, it wasn't increase of access in Bosnia and Herzegovina after the war, but restoration of services. I was very involved working in Bosnia for 6 years, and it was really a sight to see after the war. You had extensive damage both in the cities but in the utilities. You had border issues where the country, ex-Yugoslavia, was divided, where you had water resources on one side, water supply infrastructure on the other, and I think that good work was done there. Strategic work, there's a lot of strategic work that has been done. We do a lot on the economics of sanitation initiatives, and we've done one very good study which has shown that the economic costs of poor sanitation and hygiene amount to over $9 billion in 5 East Asian countries. So I think that along with the lending and the investments, the strategic work that is done, and if you can capture the support or just, you know, the attention of a minister or of a prime minister, a lot can be done with the analytical work as well. And we do a lot of public expenditure reviews, and this has been done in almost 40 countries, which helps countries prioritize spending in the water sector, to do this more on a planning and in a systematic example. I think I'm running a little bit out of time, so I had some other examples of innovative approaches, but we can talk about that in the conclusion. And I just want to conclude by saying that our focus on the MDGs is is of course to reach the targets as soon as possible, and achieving the MDGs it requires a lot. I mean, you need a vibrant global economy, you need access for the poor and health, you need education, affordable food, trade, finance, basic infrastructure. There's a lot that can be said, but I just want to point out that the one area that has to be really defined and where this needs to come from if we're going to reach our targets is the initiative has got to come from the country. You have some very serious countries. You have Vietnam, you have Honduras, you have Senegal, you have Burkina Faso that have made phenomenal results in both water supply and also in sanitation, but in a limited way. And they've had their own different strategies and national programs and very innovative approaches that are homegrown. And without the countries and their commitment, there's very little that the World Bank or other international organizations can do. And that's the role of the institutions, the role of the national institutions, and then just the political commitment from the upper echelons of the managers that are running the country, if there's really supposed to be, if there really is to be success on the ground. And I want to emphasize that point over and over again, that it has to come from the country and not from the outside. And then I'd just like to conclude by saying that even today, more than 2.2 million people die each year from poor water and sanitation conditions, and it's really a dismal number, and want to say how important it is that not just the MDGs, but the wider water supply and sanitation program, a lot of attention is focused on this. And this is what we do in the World Bank, those of us who work in the sector, to just keep on repeating these numbers and try to get as much funding and as much impact on the ground as possible in our client countries. Thank you.
Seema, thank you very much. I see a few people standing in the back of the room, and I think there's one chair over here if someone wants to come and take a seat up front, and there may be another back there in the back. So don't be shy if you'd like to come up and sit and take a seat. Seema, thank you. You've provided a wonderful overview of the statistics in terms of where we are in terms of meeting the water and sanitation target, the World Bank's work on water and sanitation, and how the Millennium Development Goals are part of a broader approach both to water and sanitation and development, a snapshot of some of the challenges but also successes, particularly in post-conflict settings, and a sense of what we might expect coming out of the water and sanitation focus at the summit, some of the events that are going on, but again, kind of the cautionary note that with the financial crisis, some of these issues may take longer to resolve than I think we had hoped. Let me now turn to John Barrazzo for his perspective. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to try to keep it a little bit fresh, even though a lot we share are actually based upon Seema's remarks, a lot of common ground in terms of looking at the way we look at this issue. I suppose that Catherine invited me to participate in this event because, as I've understood it, CSIS sent out this invitation to both its global water and its global health lists, and I occupy a relatively unique position as an environmental engineer heading up a maternal and child health division within the Bureau of Global Health at USAID. And as just to amplify what Catherine just said, Seema did an excellent job, I think, laying out the snapshot of where we are and what the challenges are, particularly some of the specific regional challenges in reaching the water and sanitation targets. But in the interest of trying to keep my remarks relatively brief, I'm going to just target a few areas of interest, hopefully, to this audience. One is going to be looking broadly at the specific interface of water-related issues writ large with maternal and child health, something I particularly focus on, and looking at both at the policy and program levels. And the second is a quick snapshot, an overview of USAID's activities, you know, also including some work around UNGA next week or whatever, high-level plenary next week, and as well as our current programs and plans in the sector. So first on the water and health interface, and some of this will just provide another perspective on some of the same things that Seema has already mentioned. It's clear that achieving and also sustaining increased access to safe drinking water and sanitation does in fact require multi-sectoral collaboration. I'll come back to that. The second, and this is also something which is going to amplify some of the remarks that Seema made, is that we often speak of water and sanitation as if it's one thing. Many of you are probably familiar with the acronym WASH, Water Supply, Sanitation, and Hygiene. And it's not one thing. So we want to come back to that. How do they differ? And Seema introduced that topic. I want to talk a little bit more specifically about how do we take action on that. And then finally, for state-of-the-art water supply, sanitation, and hygiene activities, there's been some renewed consideration of the role that these can play in health programs, particularly maternal and child health programs. And I'm going to talk about why that's happened and some of the ways it has happened. So first, on the first point, consideration of water writ very large as a development issue is clearly cross-cutting. And it includes not only the targets that we're considering focused this morning, but also productive uses of water, primarily for agriculture in the context of our development programs, water resources management, and the role of water in preserving peace and security, transboundary conflict, but also internal conflict. It's also important to acknowledge that it's not clearly USAID's development programs don't necessarily align goal for goal, objective for objective, with the Millennium Development Goals. There are a number of activities that may be explicitly focused on increasing access to water and supply and sanitation per the MDG 7 targets, but there's many activities, whether they be cross-cutting activities that involve it could be in a health program where the primary objective may be reducing child mortality. It could be an economic growth activity where the primary activity is stimulating microenterprise development. There are a number of different ways in which things that could relate to MDG 7, in fact, play out within a large development and multifaceted development organization like USAID. The provision of sustainable services does require the involvement of multiple disciplines. So let's take for example, including water expertise in water resources availability, both now and in the future. Seema mentioned in passing the importance of looking at climate change as a long-range impact on our efforts. Well, it's clear we have to consider the disruptions that will occur with the anticipated disappearance of glaciers in both the Andes and Himalayas. We're actually doing some work now to look very forward-looking work, what would happen to potential for water supplies for multiple uses in areas that are fed by Himalayan glacial melt. Second, another area of expertise, those who understand behavior change and hygiene promotion, and those are often skills that you're found within health sector programs, within health sector activities. Third is the downstream impacts of community sanitation. If we think about sanitation writ large as simply containment of feces, but we also acknowledge that as you go into urban areas and you concentrate that waste stream, there's many downstream impacts that have to be considered, as well as the impacts on ecosystem and particularly coastal ecosystems if you look at wastewater-borne solutions. So just to generalize the point, there are a number of different disciplines that have to be brought to bear on this problem. As a good example, USAID has worked with the Water and Sanitation Program and the World Bank and the government of Ethiopia to look at developing a tripartite agreement amongst several ministries, all of which has responsibility for a particular dimension of improving water supply and sanitation. That included the Ministry of Water Resources, which is responsible, in essence, for all things wet, water and wastewater, the Ministry of Health, which had a national strategy declared for improvement of sanitation and hygiene, but didn't have an action plan for actually doing anything with that, and the Ministry of Education, which assumed responsibility for water sanitation and hygiene in schools. And the ways that these came together, both at national level in terms of establishing this as policy, but then subsequently at the state level within Ethiopia and working with the corresponding bureaus, really was a very successful model for how to roll out what essentially required careful coordination amongst different sectoral actors. I'll come back to the Ethiopia example again in a moment. So even though we sometimes perceive these MDG 7 targets to be standing alone, and we focus on, and there will be a focus next week on what's being accomplished towards those specific MDG 7 targets with the distinctions between water supply and sanitation, it's clear that actually reaching those targets is going to require effective intersectoral action and probably more effective intersectoral action than we've seen to date. On the second point, this idea that we talk about water supply and sanitation as if it's one thing, you know, even if you hadn't heard the term WASH before you walked into the room, you probably had. You've already probably gotten used to hearing me say it several times and say, well, that makes sense. But water supply, as Seema mentioned, is often very distinct from sanitation, and I think it's actually very distinct, frankly, in terms of the programs, the approaches, and the institutions that are involved. And it's not just an urban-rural distinction, but just the nature of who has responsibility for water supply and who has responsibility for sanitation. You know, particularly when you get away from necessarily the strong emphasis on waterborne sewerage as the most desired means of sanitation, but look specifically at the importance of household level investments. As you might have gathered from the first point, the sustainable provision of water supply in terms of this multi-sectoral dimension to it is not necessarily a simple thing. And so while there has been effective advocacy and careful definition of the health impacts of all of these problems, and we know how many children are at risk, and we know how the impacts it might have on those suffering from HIV/AIDS in terms of increased morbidity, the fact of the matter is the health sector's response has typically been, yes, we know this is an important public health need, but there's not much that's in our manageable interest to do about it. And that's because if you look at this, ultimately it's the definition of a problem is not sufficient. What you really have to figure out is how do you define the solution in which you're asking somebody to take action and make an investment. Formally, I originally said formally, and I hesitated to use that word because I don't want to think that it's completely gone, but the discipline of public health engineering served to bridge this a little bit between the infrastructure communities and the public health communities. But, you know, the public health community around 1980, with the definition of selective primary health care, really steered away from defining a role, a programmatic role for itself in the provision of water supply and sanitation and the improvement of hygiene. And so it's taken a long time, I think, for that to start to turn around. There are key roles that the health sector can play in water supply, particularly around the issues of ensuring adequate quality, but especially around sanitation. I think Seema rightfully pointed out that sanitation has been lagging. I think it's also important that it'll get a lot of attention next week at the MDG summit. But we really have to define, in fact, okay, so what is it that we're going to do? So let's take a cue again from this work that was done in Ethiopia, which has, again, relied very heavily on the government of Ethiopia's commitment to doing something about a very important problem, where they, through their health extension program, which they were deploying starting in the mid-2000s, you know, put 32,000 community health workers in the field. And of those 16 training modules that were established for those community health workers, 9 of the 16 dealt with issues of sanitation and hygiene. So there was clearly a strong commitment on the part of the government of Ethiopia working with partners, establishing these training modules. And as a consequence, they were able to increase sanitation coverage in rural areas of Ethiopia from 12% in 2003 to 55% in 2009. And the key thing with these approaches really focused on behavior change and promotion as opposed to construction activities. So there are some things out there that point to the potential way forward. Now, there may be issues that need to be addressed regarding the quality of those services, but simply the simple fact of ending open defecation and moving people onto some kind of sanitation solution is a very good start, and I think that's an important role for the health sector to play. So finally, on my third and final point for this piece of it was how can this more effectively interface with maternal and child health? Well, it does build upon something which I've just mentioned. I want to add that during the International Year of Sanitation in 2008, and I always have to say don't put too much weight behind these international years of this or that, 2008 was also, as I found out, the International Year of the Potato. But it did provide, if for nothing else, an excuse for people to put things out there around sanitation. And so, you know, there was considerable attention paid to this lag or lack of progress in sanitation, and it was including the attention paid in The Lancet, which most of you probably know is a very influential international public health policy and research journal. And The Lancet twice in 2008 featured the lack of attention to sanitation by the public health community as either a cover story or as a leading editorial. And partly because of this, but for a variety of other reasons, this has resulted in new interest in sanitation and hygiene within the health sector. And particularly because, as I mentioned a moment ago, it's been clear that these state-of-the-art approaches, largely centering around behavior rather than infrastructure, are amongst the most cost-effective tools we have for the prevention of mortality and morbidity from diarrhea. You can look at the full rack-up. You compare it with standard. You compare it with treatment of diarrhea. You can compare it with a number of the other public health interventions we have. We know that basic sanitation. We're not talking here about large-scale municipal wastewater collection and treatment, but basic sanitation and hygiene promotion are amongst the most cost-effective tools we have for reducing diarrhea. If you look at it in dollars per dally saved, the other piece of this that's important is that. This change in practice with respect to hygiene, you know, where does hygiene fit into this whole picture? Hygiene is not really part of the MDG 7 targets. It's not something you get credit for. It doesn't change access to either water supply or sanitation. However, it's critical and very important for the MDG 4 target on child health, less so probably for maternal, except for certain dimensions of maternal mortality, but very important for child health, as was mentioned earlier. So even if hygiene is not a direct contributor to MDG 7, it is a direct contributor to MDG 4, and it's clear that the promotional efforts that help increase demand for water supply and sanitation, the promotion efforts around hygiene also help build demand for water and sanitation infrastructure that helps to ensure good hygiene. So it's a part of that building increased and building effective demand. I've got to wrap up. At the policy level, this increased acceptance of a role for the health sector in sanitation hygiene has also carried with it importance, the mention of water supply. In some ways, again, that lumping of water supply sanitation, they say, well, okay, we understand what we can do on sanitation hygiene. Let's just throw water supply in there for good measure. And you look at a statement that just was released, the UN Secretary's Global Strategy for Women's and Children's Health. It was released on August 31st. It's going to be launched next week. If you look at that, it contains the word water 13 times, the word sanitation 11 times, although the word hygiene is not mentioned at all. But this clearly, it's a little bit more on the screen than it used to be. So for maternal and child health, at least, there's not only recognition that inadequate water supply and sanitation contributes significantly to child deaths, but there's something that can actually be done about it. So I'll just turn briefly to what the U.S., particularly USAID, is doing to support the MDG 7 targets. You know, over the past 4 years, USAID has significantly increased its funding in the water supply and sanitation arena and changed, and I think my point of view, significantly changed the way we're doing the business and the attention we're paying to the water supply and sanitation. We have devoted over the course of those 4 years, from 2006 to 2009, over $1 billion of assistance, you know, working with cooperating countries on activities targeted at improved water supply, sanitation, and hygiene. In 2009, of the $600 million for overall water-related activities, more than $480 million of the $600 million was devoted specifically to water supply, sanitation, and hygiene activities in 57 countries. So it's been skewing towards an increase over these 4 years as well. USAID provided assistance during 2009 to either first time or improved access. This is not exactly the MDG 7 target. MDG 7 target is for new first time improved access. Either first time or improved access to more than 6 million people, and first time or improved access to sanitation for more than 3 million people. You said we are working very closely with the State Department to strengthen our activities in water supply and sanitation and water more generally. These touch on so many of our development portfolio, and we're really building upon what was for the first time a very high level political commitment to the issue. Some of you may have been at Secretary Clinton's World Water Day speech last March at National Geographic. That was a very significant event. We've rarely had such high-level attention paid to water issues, and particularly the issues of water supply and sanitation. For health, we are continuing to strengthen the role of water-related programming within our Global Health Initiative, where water supply and sanitation, hygiene, play critical roles, as we've already heard, in reducing morbidity and mortality. We're placing new emphasis, as consistent with what I was saying earlier, on sanitation and hygiene, and we are in the process right now of working to define, you know, new country activities where the criteria will be demonstrated gaps in coverage, the need in terms of health, and the opportunity and resources to make a difference. This also is important for the United States, the United States Feed the Future initiative. This and the links to nutrition that have already been mentioned. It also cuts across more broadly than just water supply and sanitation to also increase water availability for productive use, since food availability is also an important component in terms of nutrition. And finally, the USAID recognizes that a lot of this in terms of sustainability only is going to be valuable if it's set within the broad context of effective, integrated, and participatory water resources management. It's clear that water supply needs to be considered within the broader water resources context, and such an integrated approach will ensure that we'll have safe supplies of both surface water and groundwater to meet all those diverse development needs, the human needs, the economic development needs, and environmental requirements for as the foundation for our overall development approach. I'm going to skip the point on climate change. This point on one note on what we're doing on UNGA, and if you want to track what USAID is doing, going to be doing at UNGA across the board, not just in water, you can look at the USAID website where it's prominently featured on usaid.gov. This event that Seema mentioned earlier is actually being co-hosted by the U.S. along with the governments of Liberia, Senegal, Tajikistan, Japan, and Korea. And it's really a high-level breakfast to help lay out some of the key messages that we hope member states will take into the official UN MDG roundtables. And as you may be aware, most member states were assigned to one of the MDG roundtables. So it's not as if the United States, for example, is in the MDG 7 roundtable. We want to be able to promote the key messages that should be taken into that agenda. Finally, I'd like to emphasize that the resources of any individual organization or country has available to address the needs in water and sanitation are inadequate. I mean, it's clear from Seema's broad picture of the global requirements of $30 billion a year, and we're not halfway there. I have a colleague who always points out in any of these discussions or on any international public health issue that the Montgomery County school budget is a little over $2 billion a year. So we have to keep in mind that the kinds of things we're talking about cost real money, and frankly, even if you talk about $1 billion a year by any individual organization or several billion dollars a year, it's still not quite what we need. So the question is, how do we work more effectively in partnerships? We have multi-sectoral partnerships, as I've discussed, but specifically we also work in our bilateral partnerships with countries in the context of country-led processes and activities. We work with many non-governmental sector actors who are important contributors to our efforts. And these would include implementing partners such as the international PVOs, who often can bring their own considerable financial and human resources to the table. We work closely with the World Bank, as I mentioned, looking at this example from Ethiopia. And it's just a quick aside. Seema mentioned the reluctance of many countries to take loans for things that are not infrastructure activities. It's also often turned out to be a very good complementary role for USAID on the ground in country to be able to play the role of providing grant-funded technical assistance to complement loans that may be taken by a country from the World Bank. This MOU that she mentioned is in the process of being finalized. Obviously, the strength that she mentioned of USAID as being a decentralized, country-focused organization, but clearly the MOU, which is a central MOU, will hopefully help facilitate some of those country relationships. We also work closely in partnership with several philanthropic organizations. An example is our international H2O collaboration with Rotary. We're piloting new partnership models with them in three countries right now, the Dominican Republic, the Philippines, and Ghana. We also work under our Global Development Alliance with the commercial private sector, and there's both the international private sector, such as work with Coca-Cola and with some of the work we're doing around point-of-use water disinfection products with Procter & Gamble, with Medintec, and with Unilever. But also the local private sector. How do you partner more effectively with the local private sector, particularly around these issues that in the health sector we potentially could have a role in sanitation and hygiene, where the local private sector can really contribute a lot in terms of products and promotion? And so I don't really have sufficient time to go into too much detail about any of the partnerships, but it's something that's actually I personally am very enthusiastic about, so I would welcome the opportunity to talk about it some more in discussion. So thank you very much. I appreciate the attention. I think we've gone a little bit over between the two of us, but hopefully have enough time for some discussion.
Don, thank you very much for the reminder that the WASH sector is not really a sector, but many, many different activities that are often discussed together, but may need to, you know, be disentangled at various moments. You stress the importance of a multi-sectoral approach involving not just agencies such as dealing with water, health, and education, but also the local private sector. An important reminder of the roles that funding, hardware, behavior change, and partnerships all play in bringing a renewed focus to water and sanitation and the links to health and development agendas more broadly. And finally, a little bit of a preview in terms of what the United States will be doing in partnership with other organizations, with the United Nations and other countries, to try to highlight and raise awareness about the importance of MDG 7 and the target on water and sanitation as the high-level participants go into the meetings next week. So we have time for questions and for some discussion. We've got a microphone at the back. So if you are interested in pursuing some of the comments that were made and finding out a little bit more about some of the examples and thoughts that John and Seema have advanced, please just kind of raise your hand and we'll bring a microphone to you. And I just ask you to say your name and your affiliation. So yes, please, here in the front.
Mark Miller from the Fogarty International Center and IH. Lately, there's been an increased awareness and support for such groups such as Engineers Without Borders and recognition that the importance of engineering, and I think it came up also by both of your talks, given the fact that the World Bank has at least longer-term financing, at least longer than most other agencies. How much investments are you putting into schools of engineering? Because that seems to be a shortage of, at least within country, to make something like this sustainable.
We have, it's difficult to emphasize education in terms of, well, this is for engineering, this is for science, this is for math, and so so when we're looking at education programs or lending for education, it's usually for reform within the education sector, or it's for improvement of training for teachers and such. It's not specifically targeted at increasing the number of doctors or increasing the number of engineers. But without a doubt, when the core curriculum is reviewed, the engineering aspect and the technical aspects of the programs and ensuring that they're well covered are assessed and worked very closely with the government. Now, very interestingly, countries, as you know, like China, India, the Czech Republic, a lot of East Asian countries, a lot of South Asian countries, and interestingly, even Argentina and Brazil are putting out many, many more engineers than the U.S. and Europe. And so I'm not sure if there's a huge need in at least a majority of our countries for targeting engineering, because the countries themselves are doing it so well. But of course, when you get into some of the countries in Africa, some of the lower income ones in South America, then this is a problem. But it's looked at as a curriculum as a whole, but not increasing a certain profession or professionals.
Thank you very much for your presentations today. I'm Heather Allen from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and I guess my question to you would be, looking at the summit next week, what is it you would like to see from high-level ministers around the world? What can they say about water and sanitation that will move us closer to the MDGs?
Okay, so I'll speak personally and not institutionally. I think it should have generally come across that my perspective on this really rests very, very strongly on a multi-sectoral approach, interdisciplinary approach. It would be great for there to be statements coming out of the summit next week in which that was acknowledged. I think that the fact that you don't necessarily still see high-level statements, not just acknowledging problems, but actually saying, here's what we are going to actually specifically do about them from our different sectoral perspectives, would be actually be quite valuable. I mean, from where I sit in, for example, looking primarily at this through the health lens, I still think there's too much acknowledgement, too much discussion of what the problem is, but not enough discussion of what the solution is. So that's an example.
I would very much agree with what John said, and I think it would be it's very important that the summit is taking place, the fact that we will have high-level participation from all over the world. But I think it would be, again, personally and not from the institutional, just like John said, is that there just be funds that are committed and along with resources, really, that commitment that is made. So it's not just for the moment in New York during that two or three particular days, but this continues well into the next 5 years, but also beyond that.
My name is Carlos Linares from International Relief and Development. I have heard in sessions like this and also in individual conversations, World Bank professionals and USAID staffers, professionals, say that they really don't know if they are reaching the poor with their programs. There have been increases in coverage in the past few years, but we really don't know if what they say is correct, whether this this is reaching the poor or not. What kinds of approaches are, in fact, reaching the poor that you can speak about? Does, for instance, stimulating micro credit schemes in water supply work for reaching the poor? What other examples are there?
It gives me the tough one. It's a very good point, and I think that, as you mentioned, this is something which is a huge concern for all of us. And it goes a little bit back. There's many answers to this, but when you are working with countries, you need to ensure that whatever funding you're financing, that this will be implemented. Unfortunately, and maybe this is not fair to say, but the capacity is usually the weakest where there are the most poor. And what the bank tries to do is we try to allocate as much financing as possible as you can to the low-income countries, but there's the absorbing capacity, there's the ability to repay, and that's at the macro level. So you haven't even gotten into actually specific programs on microenterprises or rural water supply or other areas where you would target the poor. But we have various pro-poor urban strategies. We have various pro-poor rural strategies. We spend a lot of time and effort on targeting and trying to provide analytical support with data, quantifying it, and reaching out to ministers of finance and the different ministries, be it health, be it education, be it water, be it energy, of how services should be set aside for the poor. We have various subsidy strategies on how to target the poor. And this is, just some examples of a broader picture of what we do. I can speak on a very micro level that when you're preparing projects, and let's say you're in a middle-income country, then you really try to target programs, for example, wastewater treatment, which will impact everyone. So you try to sort of put in programs in place that have an overall impact, an overall good. And then within programs, you also try to install pilot programs where you know that we are a bank, and so the issue of repayment but yet being a development bank, this needs to be balanced out. You try to target specific pilot programs where you know that the capacity is very low, you know that you will not be repaid, but you somehow try to work with your counterparts at the Ministry of Finance to include them in your programs. So one is on the analytical side, on the strategies, and trying to reach out with that information flow and trying to promote that with your respective clients. And then the other is actually in implementation, where you're trying to reach out for financing. And it's not easy, because even the governments and such have to repay, and they have their own programs in place, and they generally don't want external banks or external development agencies to address it. So there's a lot that goes into play here, but it's very important and much, much more needs to be done.
Just a very brief additional comment on this. One of the ways I think we can effectively make sure we're targeting the poor is to just also, as part of our monitoring and evaluation, make sure that we're looking at what's happening specifically for lower income and populations. I mean, the World Bank has done this great work in terms of its health and poverty analysis to reanalyze country-level DHS data from many countries in which we have some better understanding of what's going on by economic or by wealth quintile, and just to continue to monitor that we actually are seeing changes for those. This would be an important part of our monitoring and evaluation.
Thanks. First of all, I wanted to thank you all for your comments. It's great to get these overviews before the General Assembly next week. And my question was linked to something that was mentioned earlier about sanitation and how you had said, I think, Samra, about the fact that there's less private sector interest in moving forward with sanitation. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that, because I find that intriguing.
There is far less private sector. Part of it just has to do with the profit aspect of it. Water is a never-ending commodity, so to speak, in terms of profit, or as that is seen by the private sector. And there was a lot of interest about 10, 15 years ago in privatization of water utilities, and it was seen as something where you could generate business from it. Sanitation is just not seen in that way yet. And I think it largely has to do with the economics of it, but partly because so few of these private operators have actually ventured into the sanitation side. Now, interestingly, from the country perspective, they're very reluctant to let private operators in, even for a small duration of 5 years, 10 years, depending on the type of contract, on the water supply side, to let go of that service. But they would be much more willing on the sanitation and the sewage side. So it's quite ironic, but largely it has to do with the economics of it. Very, very difficult to get people to pay as well, both for water supply, but particularly for sanitation.
I just want to offer some slightly different perspective, which is I think there's lots – it really depends on the scale of the sanitation solution you're looking at. I think that this would be – I think that what Seema said is necessarily true for larger wastewater collection and treatment options for sanitation. But certainly in the stimulation of household investment, the role of local suppliers of household-level hardware can be truly a vibrant private sector enterprise. We have a regional activity operated out of our Bangkok mission, USAID mission, called Watershed, which has absolutely nothing to do with watersheds, but is water supply, sanitation, and hygiene enterprise development, which is specifically focused on helping various entrepreneurs. But there are some very good examples in Cambodia of trying to lower the costs of the production and increase output for local providers of sanitation hardware, whether they be just latrine rings or actual latrine rings or slabs. And so there's really a good opportunity to actually look at how do you make this a viable local private sector enterprise. And I think there's a lot of good work that's going on in that sector.
Thank you. My name is Janet Fleischman with the Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS. And I want to talk to you about two related issues. Both of you mentioned the gender component of all this, but you didn't really go into detail. And given that GHI is supposed to have a women and girls-centered approach, I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more about what role you see in terms of the work you're doing in promoting that women and girls-centered approach. And linked to that, in this whole area of multi-sectoral coordination, how do you capture the multi-sectoral impact, and how do you promote the multi-sectoral work when so much of this is seen in silos?
I'll start. On the GHI, I mean, women and girls-centered is, as you know, one of the cross-cutting themes for GHI, so therefore it cuts across everything that GHI is about. In terms of the way, as we look at to better define what increased activity within health sector programs around water sanitation would look like, I think the way that the gender dimension plays into that is, one, the specific focus on sanitation, which disproportionately affects women and girls, not only in terms of health, but in terms of issues like privacy, violence, education, and across the board. So I think that's going to be an important cross-cutting dimension of the way, if we increase our emphasis on sanitation within health programs, how it has impact not only on health but on other development outcomes. And I think that the other thing is to track the impacts of our investments separately for their impacts on women and men and boys and girls. However, it actually flies in the face oftentimes of something which is really a household and community-centered approach. It's not as if we actually I don't think within the context even of a health-centered initiative try to disproportionately focus our attention on sanitation and water access and hygiene improvement for women and girls compared to boys and men. So these are community and household approaches. They involve the entire community. As for the issue of how do you better track what's happening on in terms of these multi-sectoral inputs, outputs, and impacts, we have had, most of you are aware, within the U.S., a way of trying to track our investments in foreign assistance, which is all put into a large foreign assistance framework. And when you look at how water appears in that framework, it is in many different places. It's within health. It's within its own, the water and sanitation access elements, these are called. It's within, I think it's been tracked to roughly 80 different pieces of this overall framework. It's not necessarily an easy thing to tease out, but I do think that we now have tools that allow us, because we actually are able to track the dimensions of water as it touches on each of these different pieces of our overall foreign assistance framework, that I think we're starting to get better at being able to look at those multi-sectoral inputs as well as what some of the outputs may be. Does that get anywhere near answering your question? Actually, I'm also personally going to apologize. I'm going to be dashing out this door at 10:30, despite the fact that I'd love to talk with so many of you that I know and even some of you that I don't know, but I apologize for that.
Gene Brantley from RTI. Thanks very much for your comments this morning. I wanted to ask a question about the focus on basic access and indicators. It serves a function in terms of focusing attention on delivering services to so many people who don't have basic access. But at the same time, I think it limits our attention, particularly with regard to improving the financial sustainability and management of utilities and large organizations that have to be more flexible in order to provide more kinds of service and a variety of levels of access to their populations. I think it also limits the potential for private sector activity in sanitation, where you're focusing only on the lowest end of basic access. So that's my own personal opinion. I wonder if you have any sense of whether the indicators ought to be changed, or whether they are in fact limiting the work that you're able to do.
Camille Saadé from AED. Both speakers, you talked about the too lengthy discussion on defining the problem. And you put your emphasis on the need to define the solution. How can institutions like yours, the World Bank, USAID, help define the solution given the political, economical, social environment in each of the countries that we want to serve? Before you answer, can I answer to the question or the question for to the gentleman? You mentioned something very important of microfinance, and I don't want to lose this opportunity. Microfinance is such a powerful tool that can be used by the household, either for supply, water supply, pumps, whatever, or for improving their lot. We have an example that John is very familiar with, a project of USAID in India, where we have used NGO microfinance to allow access to water filter that otherwise would be out of the reach of the household. And this has helped improve the quality of their water, and hopefully, we have not measured this, but has an impact on diarrhea or waterborne disease in the household. But let's not lose this. This is very important. We have not used it enough. Okay. Yes, please.
Hi, Owen Sanderson, Deloitte. And my question is regarding technical assistance. You mentioned how important technical and training and education is, but it's often difficult to measure, A, and B, it's often difficult to market. So how do you market these technical programs as positive solutions rather than infrastructure and water infrastructure programs? Thank you.
Thank you. So we have three questions. One on indicators and basic access. Are these misleading in terms, I'm hoping I'm capturing this right, but limiting versus successful. The second on, okay, we had spent a lot of time talking about defining the problem, but how do you in your institutions define solutions, particularly taking into account the political, economic, and social environment in different countries? And then a third on the question of technical assistance and how do you kind of think about or consider marketing technical assistance in your projects?
I want to respond first to the first question. I don't think, even though I was focused on basic sanitation, that's primarily because I was focused on, in terms of these remarks today, on what I thought was could be usefully presented to the health sector as its role. I recognize also that the language that surrounds the MDG target is around, it says basic sanitation, which came out of the, actually wasn't at the MDG, kind of didn't come out of the MDG summit, but rather out of the WSSD and Sustainable Development Summit in 2002. And that would actually, it in fact, was deliberate. I mean, there was a lot of debate about whether, in fact, you could just say sanitation and then the costs of what that particular component would look like if it was interpreted as water supply, wastewater collection and treatment would have been astronomical, and nobody would have signed off on it. So they actually looked at this and said, okay, well, maybe everybody can live with the term basic sanitation. I don't think that that really does, as a practical matter, limits what's going on the ground, because while there are going to be some places where the first step that needs to be taken is really getting eliminating open defecation. You're not going to go to Latin America, and that's not going to be your focus. Your focus in Latin America is going to be providing institutional support, the creative financing mechanisms to actually improve wastewater collection and treatment, most likely. So I think that it does relate to the second question, which was what is this going to look like in the context of specific country programs, given that there are differing political, social, and economic contexts. And I do think, I agree, that in fact, yes, there's going to be big differences across how this is going to play out in different settings. And it has to be country-driven, country-led, and country-defined. The bigger issue for me around sanitation indicators is the fact that there's the ongoing ambiguity about whether, in fact, communal solutions in urban settings can be, quote-unquote, counted towards meeting sanitation requirements. There's a lot of good examples of urban sanitation where, in fact, in urban settings, at least in my experience, the demand is high. The demand is there, and it's not driven by health. It's driven by privacy. And so how do we actually better exploit that? And one way to exploit that in resource-constrained and space-constrained settings is to look at communal sanitation solutions. So I think there's a lot of interesting things going on in sanitation, as you know, and some of them will address basic sanitation issues, some of them will address creative solutions in urban areas, and some of them will address some of the institutional and financing issues, and I think that's going on. In terms of the marketing TA question, I'll leave that more to you, Seema, but just one quick comment on that. You know, for us in USAID, the relationship that we have with countries is continuing to evolve. I mean, there are countries we're in, like India, where the monetary value of whatever we can put on the table is inconsequential compared to what the Indians are actually investing themselves. So the relationship that we have with them is evolving towards a relationship of partnership. And I think in those kinds of relationships, the role that we can provide in technical assistance is very well appreciated. It's valued, and it's something that's very well accepted. I think that there's more and more countries that are evolving to the point where our own resources basically lever the investments that are being made at the country level by the countries themselves.
Okay, I will answer the TA, the technical assistance question first, because this is really a compelling issue for us, because whenever we are doing loans or whenever we're doing investments, countries are very, very reluctant to borrow for any kind of TA. And it's essential, because really these are the areas where the advisory services, the technical assistance is required. That's what I had mentioned during my talk, where the failings usually are. And a lot of this is because our counterparts, the ministers, the utilities, don't want to have foreign consultants in the country. They don't want to borrow for money and then have to explain to their own public that, yes, we borrowed for money and we're giving $3 million, $5 million to a contract for, you said you were from Deloitte, right? Who answered to Deloitte. So this is a problem that we face constantly. But we're fortunate at the World Bank that we do have a lot of trust funds. And what we generally try to do is, particularly for the low-income country, where we can provide grants in parallel, and the Japanese, Netherlands, DFID, they've all been quite generous in providing some of these funds, and that certainly helps us. But this is an ongoing problem. I just recently negotiated a $300 million project for Turkey, and it was almost laughable. They refused to borrow anything for TA except after years of discussion, well, not years, but 19 months of discussions, they decided to borrow $150,000. And they were just very, very reluctant to sign off on that. So you've really got to know your client. You've got to prove that you can bring some added value, and then maybe they'll go there. But then I'll just give you an example. A country like Chile, which is no longer borrowing, but now about 15 years ago, they would pay the bank to come in for pension reform. Saudi Arabia today pays for technical assistance on desalinization and various other areas that they're interested in, and high tech largely. So it all varies. And not to go on too long on this, but the richer the country, the higher income it is, the more willing it is to take on TA. And the poorer it is, the more that it needs it. It is not. On your question on solutions, it's a very good question, but very, very difficult. Technical solutions, engineering solutions, financial solutions, those are very easy. The bank does it very well. But when it comes to the political economy at large, it's extremely difficult. We're doing a lot more political economy economy analysis, right now in programs. But that changes. So you do it in August, 9 months later, the political economy has changed. So it's very, very difficult. But I always say that if you're able to understand 20-25% of the externalities at play in a ministry, in a country, in a utility, in a municipality, you may get something done. So it's going to be a continuous challenge and something very difficult. On basic access, I think John answered that very well, because almost the term is sort of misleading, because there's so much that's going on the sanitation side, on the sewage side. So, but as John mentioned very well, that if you said wastewater treatment, I mean, nobody would even listen. You would immediately get a shut door. So this is a good way for buy-in, I think, the term. But many different types of programs going in that, and many different institutions at play. So we should really look beyond that, just the term basic sanitation. But without a doubt, I should say that the bank should actually just program certain amount, X percentage of funding, just for basic access. And I think that's one way that you could move the agenda forward. But generally, we end up lending to middle-income countries for large wastewater sewage schemes.
Well, we have come to the end of our time here this morning. We've had two excellent presentations and a range of questions and topics for discussion. I think we have a better understanding of progress on MDG 7 and the target on water and sanitation, what we might see on water and sanitation going into the summit, and some idea of some different kinds of measures of success coming out of the summit and going forward. So I want to thank you for being here this morning and joining us. I want to thank Katrin Bowe, Kathleen Murphy, and Julia Nagel for their help in setting this up from the CSIS team. And please join me in thanking our speakers for a very interesting talk.
Thank you.
But I think we should, as the Assembly evolves, be more explicit about this as a role.
Yes. And you were